Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Huntingdon Library for our event this afternoon with Patrick Barkham.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming along today. It's lovely to be in Huntingdon. I'm always very appreciative. I've moved back to Norfolk, which is where I grew up, and I'm always very appreciative of events in the region because normally I'm travelling far further. You're also very lucky because this is the first time I've used this new clicker that I brought, so I can now stand back like this and just click casually. Okay, so we'll just let this lady come in first. So badgers are very visible in our culture. You see brown, their faces on the brown signs signifying wildlife sites and wildlife trusts. They're the symbol of the wildlife trusts, of course, across the country. We have the lovely badger ales, the real ale from Dorset that's very popular. And the badger is also on the coat of arms of the House of Hufflepuff in J.K. Rowling. It's a little known fact that the badger is also on the coat of arms of Tesco's. And occasionally when I mention that fact, there's kind of boos ringing out from the audience, but you're obviously far too polite to do that. And that's simply because Tesco's headquarters is in Broxbourne, which is one of around 150 places in Britain that take their name from different names for the badger that we've used over the years. And obvious ones like Badger's Mount down in Kent and Brockley, of course. Brock is a popular name for the badger, but also in the north of England, the badger was known as a pate, and so you have Pateley Bridge is named after badgers too. And there aren't many animals that are written into the landscape in that way, and the badger has directly changes the shape of our landscape, but is also very visible in human culture. Of course, it's much less visible in the wild. How many of you have seen, without the help of car headlights, a badger like this in the wild? Just sort of, oh, that's pretty good. I'm pretty surprised because until about 4 years ago, I'd never seen a badger like this. And I'm extremely enthusiastic amateur naturalist. When I'm not my day job, I'm a journalist for The Guardian. And so I've always loved nature and the countryside. And I grew up in the Norfolk countryside, and I spent a lot of time in nature, but I never saw a badger like that. And part of the reason is there aren't many in East Anglia, and there certainly were far fewer when I was a boy. Even as recently as the 1980s, 1990s, there weren't many. But their numbers have recovered significantly since the late 80s, and I'm sure some of you are probably seeing badgers where perhaps you didn't before. Certainly, the Fens is about the worst place for the badger because it floods, and badgers need essentially, they like digging their sets into the side of hills, a sort of horizontal hole into the side of the hill, so their sets won't flood, and so they need a bit of undulating terrain, and that's historically why there aren't many in this part of the world. But they've certainly, their numbers have increased hugely in East Anglia compared to even when I was a boy. But I felt a bit embarrassed that I'd never seen badgers live in the wild, because this is my grandma, Jane Ratcliffe, and she was an ordinary mum of three, and after her children left home in the 1960s, she started going badger watching near her home in Cheshire. And she found great joy She'd climb up a tree, an old oak tree, and the first thing you're supposed to do when you're badger watching is get your scent off the ground so a badger can't smell you, because they're extremely secretive animals and very fearful of humans. We are their only enemy, and so as soon as they smell you, they normally disappear. But she would climb a tree, and she'd look down on these badgers below and the cubs gambolling in the bluebells in the woods, and she found great joy in this experience. But she also found pain because of 27 sets around Cheshire that she used to go and watch regularly in the late 1960s. All but one had been destroyed by badger baiters and diggers by 1973. So my grandma became one of many wildlife lovers in the late 60s who began campaigning for legal protection for the badger. And in 1973, that came to pass with the Badgers Act. And it was a really groundbreaking piece of legislation. It was the first protection for a land mammal in Britain. So we protected seals back in the 1920s, but we'd never protected any other specific mammal species. And from the Badgers Act, we then had far more far-reaching wildlife legislation in the early 1980s. And the badger is still protected respected to this day. And my grandma helped bring these laws about. She also looked after badgers that had been abandoned. This was a little cub that was found alive outside a set that had been dug. And she reared it, but she believed, she wrote a couple of books, one about badgers, but she believed that wild animals should fly high and run free, and she always put them back. She ran a kind of amateur animal hospital back in the 70s and released animals back into the wild. So in 2010, a little line appeared in the coalition agreement for the new government, and that was including a commitment to cull badgers. And my grandma passed away 15 years ago now, but I wondered what she would have made of this impending badger cull. So I sort of set out to write about the history of humans and badgers, and that's kind of what Badgerlands is. And the history can kind of be summed up in one word, and that's persecution. And these are lines from John Clare, the peasant poet of Northamptonshire, who wrote a brilliantly compelling poem about a badger bait that involved his whole village, the whole rural life there, and men and everyone, boys, would get together, and the badger is the hymn in this poem. And so they'd get a forked stick and bear him down and clap the dogs and bore him to the town and bait him all the day with many dogs and laugh and shout and fright the scampering hogs. And this is an image of a badger bait here. And the final lines from John Clare's poem are really quite tragic. The badger, he falls as dead and kicked by boys and men, then starts and grins and drives the crowd again, till kicked and torn and beaten out he lies and leaves his hold and crackles, groans and dies. So it had a tragic ending, and it was an interesting poem because it was one of the first to really show the badger in a sympathetic light. You feel that John Clare's allegiances are very much with the badger in this story rather than the whole village that ganged up on the badger. But this reflects the fact that badger hunting was a sort of rough and ready village pursuit. It was a pursuit carried out by working people. There's a real interesting kind of class divide that defines our relationship with mammals in this country, and the fox and the red deer in particular, and also the hare to a lesser extent, they had some protection because the aristocracy deemed them worthy of hunting, and so they were protected. Foxes in many cases were almost farmed to ensure there was a plentiful supply for the red-jacketed aristocrats to hunt every year, whereas the badger, basically, digging a badger from a set was a sort of rough and ready pursuit. It was hard work, and the aristocrats weren't interested in it. The ruling classes weren't terribly interested in, and you couldn't hunt a badger on horseback. They're nocturnal creatures. They're extremely elusive. So the badger didn't make very good sport. So the ruling classes basically left it alone and just allowed the working people to have what sport they wanted with it. And because, you know, working people back in the 18th century couldn't touch almost any wildlife in the country without getting, you know, sent to Australia and things like that. So the badger, at least here, was an animal that they could hunt and torture with impunity, essentially. And rather strangely, hunting the badger has continued, but it migrated into towns. And today, unfortunately, slightly bizarrely, badger baiting still goes on, and it tends to occur amongst people who live in former mining towns in northeast of England, South Wales. It's a very peculiar social phenomenon, and obviously it's illegal, it's not promoted anywhere, but it seems to be passed on from father to son as this rather odd, illicit tradition, a bit like dog fighting and that sort of thing. But one of the reasons, I think, why the badger has suffered such persecution is ignorance, and we can see it over the centuries here in these different quotes. Nicholas Cox was a hunting author, and he had an unusual theory about the badger. He theorised that the badger's back was broad, and his legs are longer on the right side than they are on the left, and therefore he runneth best when he gets on the side of a hill. So he doesn't quite explain how the wonky-legged badger would then turn round and walk home again without toppling over. But it is true, if you see a badger running across the field, they do have this sort of ambling, shambling kind of gait, and that reflects that. But it reflects how little was known about the badger. And in the 20th century, we see the badger was a fairground attraction. There was this monster badger which allegedly terrified the district with its destruction of sheep and cattle. In fact, this particularly large badger lived on a diet of cod heads from the fishmonger and was very happy for that. And then we see the ignorance continuing right up until today, and Owen Paterson, the last but one Environment Secretary, spoke in the House of Commons back in 2012 of the need to bear down on wildlife. And this was a Freudian slip. He actually meant he wanted to bear down on the disease of bovine TB in wildlife, but many people felt this revealed his true intentions towards many wild animals in this country. But 1908 was a year of when our relationship with the badger was transformed, and it was a year of great change in society. The Edwardian period was a time when our countryside was changing hugely with urban development and the rise of the motor car and railways, and there were some interesting events this year. Baden-Powell started the Boy Scouts, London hosted the Olympics, but the key thing here from a badger's point of view is the Secretary of the Bank of England quit his job to devote his life to writing, and that year he published a book which really has changed our perspective on the badger, and I'm sure some of you can guess what that was. It was The Wind in the Willows. Kenneth Graham was that secretary from the Bank of England. And it's, I'm sure some of you remember it. Rereading it as an adult, I was really surprised by how lovely some of his descriptive writing is of the countryside, how true it is, just beautifully simple and true. But his portrait of the badger is also very true. And the first time badger is mentioned in The Wind in the Willows, mole catches sight of him peering from a hedge. Badger trotted forward, grunted, company, and disappeared again. Simply hates society, explained the water rat. And that perfectly illustrates the badger's elusive character in the countryside. And of course, Badger in The Wind in the Willows was the authority figure. He was the moral core of the story. He was the leader of animals and men. He fought the good fight against the decadent toad and the sneaky weasels. And his home, his set, some of Graham's descriptions of his set, it was every child's fantasy of warmth and safety. It was kind of a description of an Edwardian kitchen. It's a most wonderful thing. And some of the reviews from the time are quite hilarious in that they don't really get this book. It was a bit of a slow burner. It wasn't immediately a great success, but Richard Middleton in Vanity Fair wrote, "The book is notable for its intimate sympathy with nature and for its delicate expression of emotions," and I think that's spot on. But 4 years later, the then superstar of children's literature, Beatrix Potter, produced an entirely different portrait of the badger, Tommy Brock. And I don't know if some of you remember the tale of Mr. Todd, but Tommy Brock actually outwits the fox. He's considered to be craftier, cleverer than the fox in Beatrix Potter's story. And he's an unpleasant individual. And in that sack on his back, he's carrying a load of baby rabbits. And Peter Rabbit stops him and goes, "What have you got in your sack, Tommy?" And he goes, "Oh, only some caterpillars." So he's sneaky and he's a liar and he's duplicitous. And Beatrix Potter's description of him, it's almost like she's describing a badger digger. His clothes were very dirty, and as he slept in the daytime, he always went to bed in his boots. And yet this negative portrayal of the badger never really caught on. And I feel it's perhaps because it was less true to the spirit of the species than Graham's portrayal. And in fact, badgers aren't very intelligent at all. Scientists say that they're in a stage of primitive sociality, which is kind of scientists' way of saying they're a bit thick. They don't do... I'm simplifying slightly, but they don't do meerkatty things. They don't look out for each other. They don't warn each other if they're foraging together that there's danger around the corner or whatever. They seem almost forced together in Britain to live alongside each other. They're very tolerant and clannish, but they don't really, there's not a lot of social communication going on. So in some senses, Tommy Brock perhaps didn't catch hold because it was just the wrong interpretation of the wild badger. But ever since then, we've had rounds and rounds of fictional badgers in children's literature. We had things like Policeman Badger, the Road Safety Badger from the 1960s. The badger was often a rather boring authority figure, but he was always a good person. And it was always a he, in fact, very rarely a female in these children's books. But there were loads of heroic badgers over the decades. And I think we as a society, we've obviously been conditioned slightly from how we've seen the badger in children's literature. And we often see it now as a very cute and cuddly animal. And this was an excuse to give you a few cute pictures of badgers, to be honest. Look at this. I mean, they are very sweet. And you can see why they were originally wrongly thought to be members of the bear family. They're like sort of little cuddly bears. And this is one. This is in Secret World in Somerset, which is a badger rescue centre. And they even have heat lamps for the badgers. So they're cared for incredibly well. And but so as through Badgerlands, I sort of investigate the history of humans and badgers, but I also set out to see badgers myself. And my first attempts were at this place, Wookie Hole in Somerset, simply because I knew a farmer who had some badger sets on his land. And I hope I present in Badgerlands a very balanced and fair look at the whole issue of badgers and bovine TB. And I do put across the farmer's point of view, and I spent a lot of time in farmers' kitchens. And this farmer at Wookie Hole, he's very typical of farmers in that he didn't like badgers, but he didn't hate them either. And he did farm alongside them, and he lived alongside them, and he didn't want to exterminate them. And as his neighbour said, why would we exterminate badgers? We're too blimmin' tired in the evening, you know. Why would we go out tracking down this elusive animal and killing it? So I think he's representative, probably, of the majority of farmers. They don't like them, but they live alongside them, as the badger has lived alongside us. But I saw no badgers in two nights at Wookie Hole, probably because I was dressed like this. I had my badger onesie on, and I don't think it was quite the right disguise. But you can see I'm climbed up a tree there, and here's the, I'm a bit too close to the badger set here, but I'm getting the idea. And basically, you can sit up on this. You see this line here? That's a bank. You can sit up on the bank there and watch the badgers coming out, and it's a really, really magical experience when you first see a little nose poking out of the set, and it's like a little finger puppet or something, and it's or a sommelier in the way it sort of sniffs the air for promise and danger, and often retreats back inside again and comes out again, and you just see that nose sniffing and sensing, probably sensing you and working out whether you're a threat to it or not, and then hopefully emerging and coming out like this. And this is a sort of lovely scene in an English woodland. These were actually taken by a wildlife photographer called James Warwick, who has spent 25 years photographing big game in East Africa, and 2 years ago moved back to Britain and began photographing badgers in a wood. And I asked him about how they compared, and he said, well, obviously nothing quite sets your heart racing like seeing a big cat up a tree, but he felt the overall atmospheric pleasure of being in an English woodland in July and seeing something like this really exceeded being sat on the back of a Land Rover sort of taking shots of safari animals like paparazzi, you know. And it's certainly the skill involved in getting shots like this. He had to spend 50 hours out before the badgers got used to his scent and would tolerate him being this close. He took this with a remote control camera, so you can see how the young badgers have got used to him. And that was after a few weeks. So you sort of invest time in a scent, and the badger can get used to your scent. But the older badgers never got used to him and were still afraid of him. But the yearlings, the younger badgers, did become more familiar with him and more tolerant of his presence. But this isn't taming badgers, of course. It's the ultimate wild animal. And if anyone else had been there, they would have smelt a foreign scent and not come out at all. They'd simply got used to his scent. So I sort of spent a lot of time watching badgers, but also looking at different ways in which we interact with them, and that includes lots of people feed them now from their patio doors. Or this is a badger, an urban badger in Bristol, and a lovely lady called Maureen Davies cooks a big dinner for it every night and puts it out on the cemetery railings, and it hops up and eats the food. And the fact that many of us are feeding badgers is one reason why their numbers are increasing, certainly in semi-suburban areas. I also looked at trapping badgers and injecting them, vaccinating them, which is very much a sort of big society solution to the problems of bovine TB. And there's more than, I think there's 16 wildlife trusts now doing this around the country, very successfully as well. And it's proving to be cheaper than shooting badgers. So it's actually cheaper to vaccinate them than it is to cull them. And I spent a fascinating couple of days in Gloucester doing this trapping and vaccinating. I didn't have the qualification to actually inject the badger myself, but I stood back with a clipboard and did pharmacovigilance, it's called, where you check the badger's okay. But the really interesting thing, I'm a huge butterfly lover and always have been, and I like to theorise that that butterflies have different species of butterfly have different ways of behaving, and almost like different personalities, different character traits. But it's simply different ways that their species has found works. But within a species of butterfly, there aren't individual differences in behaviour. So one meadow brown behaves much like another meadow brown, and so forth. But with badgers, they are really very like, you can see why people become attached to them, because they are very like our pets, our cats and dogs, and individual badgers behave very differently to the same stimulus. So we caught 13 badgers on one morning. They're very easy to trap. We set 20 traps, we caught 13, and each one responded to this predicament of being in a cage completely differently. Some were incredibly relaxed, some went to sleep, some made themselves nests and covered themselves in grass that then pulled in from around the cage. Others were banging on the door of the cage, and it was almost quite distressing to see that. But and then they whizzed off, and one, it was almost like the one badger had Stockholm syndrome. It didn't want to leave the cage. We opened up the gate, we had to shoo it out. It came out, it kind of sniffed our legs and then trotted off extremely calmly. So it's fascinating how different they are. And I also, as part of my investigations into human and badgers, ate this plate of food. You can probably imagine what this is. This is stir-fried badger with hoisin sauce from Asda. And it's probably the most ethical meat you could eat, because it's roadkill, badger, so it's accidentally killed. It's the wasteful byproduct of our overpaced society, if you like. It's coming to no use at all, lying by the side of the road. And I befriended a roadkill expert who eats lots of roadkill, and he agreed to procure me a badger. And I went round to his flat in Bournemouth, and there was a slightly strange smell in the air, and it was a long journey getting there, and I needed to use his bathroom. So I went to his bathroom, and there, lying in his bath, was a badger waiting to be butchered. I didn't quite realise we'd have to butcher it ourselves as well. And I ate the plate of meat whilst chatting to him, and he was a very interesting guy, so it sort of took my mind off what I was actually eating. And he looked really surprised after I finished the plate. I was like, oh, most people usually just have a mouthful, but I thought it'd be impolite to leave behind lots of food. And I'm no food critic, but I would compare it to, I don't know, really gamey, really strong, and sort of old and just rancid tasting. I mean, because I guess I've already given the answer to the question that I posed. I wanted to find out why we didn't eat badger, if it was because of a taboo against eating badger, or if it was because badger tasted disgusting. And there's a wonderful writer from the 19th century who was writing about the Italians' habit of eating songbirds, and he wrote, "Eat a robin? I would sooner eat a child." Which I think wonderfully illustrates, you know, and people on the continent think it's bizarre we don't like horse meat. You know, we do have interesting taboos about what's acceptable and what's unacceptable. But having eaten this, I can confirm that badger has been a dish. It was still on menus in pubs in the West Country until the ban came in 1973, the legal protection. So it has been eaten for a long time. Smoked badger ham. You'll still get old boys in pubs in the West Country swearing that smoked badger ham is a delicacy. But, I think badger is not a widespread dish because you cannot predict what a badger will taste like. There may well be nice-tasting badgers out there, but the badger is an omnivore like us. It eats almost anything. Famously, you can serve up almost anything and the badger will eat it, and that obviously makes its meat an unpredictable flavour. If we sort of factory farmed and corn-fed badgers, they might taste quite pleasant, but so that is eating badger. But also, it's amazing the lengths we go to with badgers, and we really are a fascinating country of extremes towards animals. I think we torture and abuse animals probably more than many countries, but we certainly love animals more, and maybe it's because of class, maybe it's because of these extremes that things are very polarised in this country, certainly very polarised over badgers. But it's incredible the lengths we will go to protect badgers. This is Camo Kev, who's one of the inmates at Secret World, who had a broken leg and was successfully rehabilitated and put back into the wild. But when I was at Secret World, they had a cub there that they'd had a phone call a couple of days before. Someone had found a couple of two-day-old badger cubs washed out of a set, flooded out of a set in North Wales. A relay of volunteers drove them from North Wales to Somerset, and that cub was now going to have 3 months of the top veterinary attention money can buy. It's all funded by small donors, Secret World. It does brilliant work, and it would be released back into the wild as Camo Kev was done. Now, where else in the world would people do that for one single tiny baby animal? The Swedes, who are the only other country in Europe who have a similarly large badger population to us, would think we were crazy. They have a very sort of rational, calm view of nature, I think, and and less sentimental than ours, but also probably less brutal too. And they would think we were weird, really, for doing all this for one animal. And yet it goes on, and it's a very positive thing. You know, people doing good work for nature. One of the reasons there are more badgers in East Anglia now is places like Secret World release them into places where there are no badgers, such as parts of Norfolk and Suffolk, where they have a supportive landowner, where they have a landowner who says, yeah, I'd like more badgers on my land. So we are artificially manipulating the badger population in this way. Here's some badger cubs. I just wanted to mention this because, again, much as I love butterflies, you feel a bond with badgers, and I think it's because they're mammals. And when I was writing Badgerlands and researching it, I'd become a father for the first time, and seeing these two little baby badgers did remind me of my own baby badgers, my twins. They're 3 and a half now, but watching them sort of scurry around after each other reminded me very much of the baby badgers too. I'll just very briefly mention the badger cull. It's obviously been in the news an awful lot. We've had 2 years of an experimental 4-year programme to cull badgers in a small part of Gloucestershire and Somerset to see whether it is an effective way of controlling numbers of badgers, reducing numbers of badgers, and reducing the number of cows that catch bovine TB as a result. Mm-hmm. And we have some results, some good, robust government data from the first year of the cull. And these are those. The key thing was to assess the safety, humaneness, and efficacy, the efficiency of culling badgers. The safety to humans, no risk at all. It was carried out very safely. All this men's with guns after dark, people were a bit worried, but it was safe. Humaneness, the target was less than 5% of badgers would take more than 5 minutes to die. In reality, between 6.4% and 18% of the badgers shot in the badger cull took more than 5 minutes to die. If you think about 5 minutes, it's quite a long time. But the startling thing is the efficiency. And again, these are government figures, and I'm not taking a position on this at all. These are the facts. They wanted to kill more than 70% of the badgers in an area. This is very important to kill a significant number, because otherwise you might make the disease worse by encouraging perturbation, where the badgers mix more. And in Gloucester, you can see the targets that they hit. The best case scenario in Gloucester was they killed 39% of the badgers. In Somerset, 48%, so way below their efficiency target. The story was similar in 2014, but the government have been slightly less forthcoming over the figures because they've basically given up on counting badgers in the zones, because you can't get an accurate number for the badgers there. And the cost, this is quite extraordinary. Here's the cost per badger, £5,272 per dead badger. Now, when the Welsh Assembly, the Welsh government, are vaccinating badgers, they have a different policy to England. And in the first year of vaccination, in 2012, the first year of any programme, it's always going to be more expensive. So these costs will come down in terms of shooting badgers, but vaccinating badgers in the first year, it costs £662 per badger. And the farmers who are in favour of the cull were very critical of this. They were saying, this is crazy, you're paying £662 to vaccinate a badger, that's the overall cost of it, that's crazy. But shooting them, £5,200, that's the equivalent figure, that's a big difference. This is the sunset over the cull zone in Somerset. I've spent quite a lot of time in the last couple of years in these cull zones, kind of doing some reporting for The Guardian and also following up on things for my book. And I guess the observation I would make is, just back on the cull zone there, is that I felt it was tremendously sad that the badger cull was dividing the rural communities in Somerset. That it's lovely, it's like round here, the countryside around here, it's proper working countryside, it's not too twee, it's not gentrified, and yet the badger cull had really split local opinion, and it turned neighbour upon neighbour, and farmers, wildlife lovers, conservationists, local people, we all need to work together to preserve our wonderful countryside, because we have a unique and brilliant countryside in England. And yet measures like the badger cull are so divisive. They're clearly not very good for badgers. They're probably helping cows in a tiny way, but they certainly don't seem to be helping the human populations in these areas live harmoniously with themselves, with each other, or with our countryside. And that seems sad to me. In the longer term, the future will be vaccines, but we can talk about more that in the questions. This is just a scene from, I've slightly gone over the time, so I won't continue here, but this is a lovely lady called Judy Salisbury who feeds badgers, and if we have time at the end, I could give you a little reading about meeting Judy, but I'm aware of the time, so maybe we'll stop and have some questions now. But Judy produces this every night for her badgers, so it's an astonishing feast, and she was a wonderful woman, and I sort of enjoyed watching this theatre, which was the badgers feeding on her patio, which would horrify some animal lovers as well as farmers, but it was another interesting aspect of our complex and polarised relationship with this unique animal, our largest surviving carnivorous animal in Britain, a very special animal. I will stop there and we can ask some questions.
My question, Patrick, was to do with, to my mind, there seems to be a resurgence of writing about the natural world. I mean, you think about books like H.S. Hall, which is just, you know, amazing, you know, it's everywhere, isn't it? But there seems to be a lot more books being published that deal with people's reflections on the natural world. Do you think there's a reason behind that? Is it something you experienced? I mean, obviously, it's done quite well for you.
Yeah. I mean, there does seem to be, if you look back to the 1980s, say, there was only really Richard Mabey writing about nature in that sort of genre that we tend to call nature writing now, and it was a sort of lone voice, and yet that seems to be the beginnings of it, and the kind of rediscovery of John Clare seems to have been very important in inspiring lots of people, and people like Richard Mabey championing him, and I think it's been a steadily increasing movement, but certainly in the last 5 years it's kind of exploded, and you obviously have Rob McFarlane down the road at Cambridge University there, who's a superb writer, and I think obviously his success has perhaps surprised the publishing world in a way, and certainly publishers are very keen on nature writing at the moment. I'm not convinced there's an enormous audience out there for it as big as perhaps publishers think, but I do think certainly it's lovely when you get a book like H is for Hawk that really, I don't know how, I'm sure many of you have read it, but become sort of breaks out beyond the genre, and loads of people who know nothing about hawks and nature read it, and it works as a kind of misery memoir and a literary biography as well as a brilliant piece of poetic writing and an account of people and animals. I do think some of the reason for the resurgence is perhaps because we do have this feeling that we're perhaps estranged and alienated slightly from the natural world, and we want to reconnect with it, and certainly the reason I wrote The Butterfly Isles was my own personal desire to reconnect. I'd been living and working away in big cities for 10-15 years, and I really wanted to reconnect with the landscape of my childhood in the countryside, and I did that through writing that book. So I think many of us as readers as well are looking for that kind of connection with the natural world that perhaps, hopefully, nice writing or compelling writing can do that for us. I should just say, I just should say, my sorry.
Such a pronounced black and white head, and such a sort of plain, nondescript body.
Good question. Good question. It's the badger ecologist Tim Roper says that an animal can survive in the wild by being a sniper or a tank. And of course, the badger is very much a tank. And the badge on its face, it's all about visibility. It isn't, as you say, about camouflage at all. It's about saying, here I am, step back, keep away, I'm a formidable animal. And that thing of a badger standing its ground, a badger, the tragic thing when we see dead badgers on the roadside is often if a car comes along, they will turn and face the oncoming car and face the enemy, and that's how they see things off. That's what they do. They stay and fight. They don't necessarily retreat. And the badge is part of that attempt to be an imposing figure in the landscape, which of course is what a badger is, particularly now we've driven these more formidable mammals like wolves and bears and eagles to extinction. I was just going to say just quickly about Helen MacDonald. My claim to fame is that Helen, who is an incredibly talented polymath, illustrated my book The Butterfly Isles. And so I keep saying to the publisher they should reissue it with her name really large on the cover.
I was interested in you saying that badgers had no enemies other than humans. And is that the case everywhere in the world, or is that just in the UK?
No, that is just in the UK because we have driven more formidable animals. Like wolves would have preyed on them. Probably eagles, the big eagles like the white-tailed eagles and the golden eagles might have taken young badgers. Bears as well would have done back in the day when we had bears. Lynx, I don't know whether lynx would take a badger, but again might prey on the cubs slightly. So the badger has by default become top of the food chain in Britain, apart from us, and the only thing that controls its numbers really is the motor car, and that's what keeps its numbers down, although its numbers have gone up very significantly.
What surprised me most was the chapter where you decided you wanted to eat a badger. Why did you feel you wanted to do that?
I felt I'd been reading a bit about the sort of strange subculture of eating badger and various accounts from the 18th century of badger recipes and badger dishes, and I just felt that was part of the human relationship. No, I don't actually, no. Although when I was getting the train back from Bournemouth after my badger meal, and the badger, shall I say, it was repeating on me. So I think I was regretting it at that point. But and actually, my editor didn't want me to include that chapter. She felt it was slightly a different tone to the rest of the book, and it was slightly comic. But I just enjoyed it. To me, that was like a slightly comic aside. And, you know, I'm kind of worried that people think, because of the subject matter, that it's going to be a depressing book, and I didn't want to write a depressing book. And there's a difficult chapter on the history of persecution that I've sort of talked you through, but I'm hoping it's an uplifting book and a funny book at times, too, because we have a wonderful relationship with it, and it's an amazing animal in many ways.
Mm. The International Trust had a 5 minutes on Radio 4 this morning. They gave the figures of £240 for vaccinating.
That was at Killerton, wasn't it? At their badger experiment there. Yeah, which is really interesting. And they've discovered that the price of vaccinating badgers has gone down. You know, once you repeat it year after year, you develop efficiency savings. And also, all these vaccination programs, almost all of them, are run by volunteers, which makes them incredibly cheap. So it is through that sort of genuinely big society solution, I think there is a viable alternative to shooting badgers, to culling them, in terms of vaccinating them.
Why do you think there is resistance against a larger scale vaccination programme in British Isles?
I think in terms of recent history, it's been considered to be too expensive, and hopefully now the Wildlife Trust and people are proving that to be mistaken, but it was certainly based on economics. But I also think part of the decision to start the cull, it was symbolic politics in a way, and it was the Conservative part of the coalition government saying to farmers, we're on your side, we understand your concerns, we can do something to help you. And they couldn't repeal, for example, they don't have the numbers, even though they're going to try, they don't have the numbers to repeal the hunting act, you know, banning fox hunting, so they can't get that through. But they can say, well, we're doing this for you farmers, you know, or for you country people who earn a living from the countryside, and we're on your side. And so I think there was an element of symbolic politics to it. And I think, I mean, vaccination for wild animals, it is, logistically, it is quite complicated. Farmers are suspicious that the vaccine doesn't work very well. So far, we're still in the early days of the science, but the scientific trials that have been done, including a four-year study, were hugely encouraging. And the vaccination had a success rate on badgers of more than 65%. But the really encouraging thing was it increased what's called herd immunity very quickly. So once you start injecting badgers with this vaccine in a set, even those that don't have the vaccine, that aren't injected, become immune to the disease. And they were finding the likelihood of young cubs testing positive for bovine TB decreased by 81%. after they began vaccinating adult badgers. So you very quickly develop what's called herd immunity, and you don't have to inject every badger for a clan, a badger group, to become disease-free. So the science is quite encouraging. But it would, we have a very large population of badgers. The numbers are still, it's a little bit fought over, but the best scientific estimates suggest there are around 600,000 in England, in Britain as a whole, and so it isn't an endangered wild animal anymore. So there are large numbers, and whilst there aren't bovine TB in every badger group or set or area, most of East Anglia is completely bovine TB free, both in cattle and badgers. It would, the vaccine, it would be difficult to vaccinate every badger in the land. So there are some practical obstacles, but I do think a more fair-minded government would now give vaccination a go, a turn, and having proved that culling is very expensive. The reason that culling badgers, killing them, is so expensive is because of the protests, mainly, and so the policing costs are so large. So for that reason, you could say, well, you know, that's not the real cost of killing badgers, and it's all these badger huggers who are making life very expensive and difficult for the government. But you can also argue that they're part of the human ecology of Britain. We're not going to change their minds. These people are passionate animal lovers, very sort of steadfast in their beliefs. We're not going to change what they do. We're not going to live in a world where there aren't people who think the idea of killing badgers is abhorrent. And so we're always going to have these protests. So we have to deal with Britain as it is, both the wildlife and the people. And so I don't think those costs are going to decrease dramatically with time either.
Didn't you say in your book that the testing of the cows is has 20% failure?
That's right, exactly. The current technology, yeah, so the bovine TB test for the cows is hugely unreliable, and you often don't pick up cows with the disease, so they then spread it to other cows, or you get what's called false positives, cows testing positive for the disease when they don't have them, so they're then killed for no reason. And that's a real problem. And I've talked to veterinary scientists about that, but they say bovine TB is a very difficult disease to detect. It's very slow moving. It sort of ebbs and flows. It can kind of almost come and go within an organism. And so it's difficult to make that test more accurate. They're not seeing obvious ways of increasing its accuracy. But that is a big reason why we continue to get bovine TB spreading amongst cattle. And badgers do contribute towards bovine TB in cattle, but the most common cause of bovine TB in one cow is another cow. Cattle-to-cattle transmission is the key vector.
Just not to statement in your book towards the end of it, we're about, because we're breeding hybrid cattle now, that their resistance to TB is compromised. You mentioned where years ago we had solid breeds, I suppose.
Yeah.
Highly less, more resistant to
it. Yeah. I mean, these. These are really big issues, and a farmer put it beautifully. He said, the old milker, the old Jersey milker from the 1940s and 50s, it was like a Land Rover. It was solid and robust, and the modern cow is like a Ferrari. And I just love that analogy. It breaks down. It's unsuited to the modern farm. It has fantastic milk yields, and yet doesn't have that hybrid vigour. It's been inbred. The dairy industry is fascinating. It's all artificial insemination. It's all very centralised, and these animals are very inbred, and they are, as you say, as I put in the book, very vulnerable to disease, and vets will agree with this point. But of course, the solution to this problem, would require an industry-wide change, and most of all, I think it would require the whole of society to accept that we have to pay much more for our milk, and perhaps we should be substituting milk productivity for hybrid vigour and having slightly less productive cows that are more robust, and therefore the farmers have to get more money for their milk, and for that we as consumers have to demand that the supermarkets pay more for the milk. We have to pay more attention to the welfare standards on farms and so on. It has to come from us, really. It would be very hard to legislate for that kind of change. That could only come with consumer change, and perhaps it will with time, but I'm not hopeful. I think, if anything, we're heading towards more intensification in our farming industry, because farmers are hard-pressed. They're being pushed by supermarkets, being pushed by global capitalism, being pushed by the economic system within which we all operate to make money from their animals, from their businesses, and that puts them under pressure.
What, can you clarify what the means of transmission of TB is from badgers to cows or vice versa?
Yeah.
Is it through feces? Is it through...
It's very interesting because scientists accept that this goes on, and it's sort of widely accepted across the scientific spectrum, a bit like climate change is accepted, and yet they haven't been able to identify precisely how the disease is transmitted, and it really exists in the realm of plausible theories, and it certainly seems the case that from anecdotes but also from some experiments that bovine TB, this bacteria, is transmitted through urine and cowpats. So for example, badgers will turn over cowpats in fields to feed on beetles and pick up bovine TB from a cow, and then badgers, often some of the worst outbreaks of bovine TB have been where a badger has, farmers have been perhaps a bit careless over how they distribute extra feed to their cattle, and badgers wee on this feed because they go into the fields and feed on it, and wee or poo near it, and the cows pick it up from the badger that way. It's also carried airborne through particles, through moisture in the air, so close proximity between cows and badgers. They rarely, there's some interesting scientific work ongoing on this. Cows and badgers, there's a couple of photos you see in the media of like a badger in a field with a cow. That's vanishingly rare. They avoid each other, and studies show they do, but unfortunately badgers have these ancestral pathways that run through pasture, and they will pass within quite close proximity of a cow, but they tend to head straight past it. But it seems likely that transmission is both ways, and it's through all those ways, through the air, through feces, through perhaps even contaminated soil or grass.
Can I just ask one last question then?
Yeah.
What are you working on now?
Well, I've just finished a book called Coastlines, which is about our changing relationship with the coast through exploration of some of the 775 miles protected by the National Trust. So that was a very jolly book to write. Badgers was, you know, was difficult at times, but Coastlines was very jolly. And I'm now working on a book in a similar vein to Coastlines. I guess it's a bit more travel-y than nature writing. It's sort of landscape writing, but also social history. And it's called Islander, and it's about people who live on small islands, and I'm travelling from large small islands to ever smaller islands, ending up hopefully in theory on some maybe rock hall or some godforsaken rock off the coast of Britain. So that's another very, I'm very lucky to have that very enjoyable project.
I wanted to ask actually, how do you choose your subject matter? Because it seems quite diverse.
Yeah, that's interesting. I do think, I mean, books, and I'm sure many of you will write and perhaps have written books, but they have to be a labour of love. You know, they are a labour of love, so it has to be something from the heart. And Butterflies was absolutely, it was a completely authentic boyhood passion, and it was about reconnecting with that and the countryside. And it was a book that I was absolutely sort of compelled to write. I had to write it. With Badgers, I sort of sat back and I thought, is this something I can write about that I have a family connection to? And then I thought of my grandma, and you know, I thought of her and Badgers, and then that came about through that having that personal connection and thinking I could explore that a bit. And once you start digging into a subject, they inevitably become more and more interesting, exciting. The Coastlines book actually came to me. It was a lovely treat in that someone came to Grant, my publisher, from the National Trust and said, would someone fancy writing a book sort of about our coastline, but not in a sort of official way. So it was really nice. I wasn't controlled in what I could say. I got free rein to write about what I wanted to write about. And then I sort of sniff out the stories. I kind of take a slightly journalistic approach. I want to tell stories and find interesting stories about people and places. And I think a lot of my books end up being as much about people as they do about wildlife and nature. Would anyone like to hear a quick reading to finish?
Yes.
Is it time for that? Shall I do
yes.
a quick? Yeah, I'll do a quick reading about the scene that we see before us here. which is feeding the badgers with this lovely woman called Judy Salisbury. "Nearly time," said Judy, glancing at the grandfather clock. "It was 8:05. A feral cat named Treacle arrived on the patio, expecting to be fed. I wondered if the cat would scare off the badgers. When Judy rose and offered it a dish containing a morsel or two from the badger's feast, Treacle held out a paw as if it was saying thank you or craving the touch of a human hand. The cat disappeared again. A few minutes ticked by. It was still broad daylight outside. Suddenly, a badger. It thrust through the clotted cream-coloured elder blooms and bounced up the lawn like a little trotting horse. Judy slid the patio door ajar. "Come along," she quavered. "Come along then, I can see you." Now, I'm not making fun of Judy. She had a special badger voice, and that was her special badger voice. And if I had spoken at that point, the badger would have fled. But at her special badger voice, the badger stopped, looking towards us, ears thrust forward like miniature satellite dishes. "Here's one to take back," said Judy, throwing a sandwich. "You can find it." A second badger emerged. This one moved up the path towards the patio like a bow-legged old gardener, before turning and bolting in a suddenly acquired sinuosity of movement that more resembled a rabbit. 15 seconds later, it bobbed out again before skittishly dashing for cover once more. Like the incoming tide, this is the first badger here. It was a wet night. You can see she's quite bedraggled there from the rain. Like the incoming tide, unnoticed, four badgers had arrived on the patio. These were descendants of Dainty, Judy's first badger. Today's matriarch and the badger Judy knew best was Willow. She was paler and browner than the others, with a broader stripe down her nose. This is Willow. This year's cubs were salt, pepper, mustard and vinegar, and they looked like surreal garden ornaments, pausing and raising their noses to the air. "Would you like a sausage?" Judy called out. "Willow, have a sausage." I held out a wobbly third of a sausage, which flapped slightly in the breeze. This is Willow actually smelling my sausage at that point. When Willow came up to the top step, even my feeble nose could smell the rich musk of badger. She seemed to elongate her expressive face, snapped her jaw very precisely around my proffered treat, and she whipped it away before I could blink. I was still flinching as she retreated down the steps, head held high with her prize. As bats took to the darkening sky, nine badgers congregated on the patio, merging and separating and rippling like grey waves. The nine bodies eddied and swam this way and that, as if they were connected, a toy train of animals. It did not seem a natural scene. Most farmers, of course, would hate this kind of husbandry, but many animal lovers disapproved of feeding badgers as well. What kind of dependency was being created? What would happen to the set when Judy was no longer here? Judy's banquet was one hugely influential type of human-badger relationship, however. Here was a deep bond between an isolated elderly lady and a family of badgers, and like all things in Badgerland, it unfolded beyond the trundle of conventional life. A lot of people say, "Aren't you lonely down there on your own?" said Judy. She lived in this wonderfully isolated house. It was very cold and damp. It had a lovely view over this estuary in Cornwall, but it was a very cold and damp house. So she'd lived on her own for more than a decade. "I've never been lonely in my life," she said. "How can you be lonely down here?" And the badgers were really her sort of family in a way. She did have some family, but they lived a long way away. And every night she'd watch them from the window. And she's not long after I sort of befriended her and watched badgers with her, she fell very seriously ill and went into hospital in Plymouth. And she was gone for about 3 months, and most people thought she wouldn't get back into her home, and people wondered what would happen to the badgers. But she is incredibly tough, determined person, and she got back in her home again, and for a couple of weeks the badgers didn't arrive, and then they came back and they all returned again. So they're robust animals, and they can probably survive perfectly well without her. But I would suspect that the set that lives near Judy, the clan of badgers there, is probably larger than it would be naturally, thanks to all her feeding over the years. So thank you very much for This was a fan or a reader of Badgerland sent me this, and it's real. It's a real live badger, and he caught it just open its mouth as well. It's incredible. It's not Photoshop. I will stop talking there. But thanks ever so much for coming.
Thank you.